Ultra Talk. That's how David Kirby describes his poetry. It's conversational, but also smart, funny, and fast.
Writing poems is a matter of strategy. You think, you know, what's going to work? And that doesn't mean catering to the reader. It means, you know, often pulling the reader, you know, in a certain direction, making them do a little bit of work, but making them feel gratified that they've done it.
Peek into the imagination of David Kirby, the 2008 winner of the Florida Book Award, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. The author of 11 poetry collections, a book of essays called Ultra Talk, and some children's books, David Kirby has a loquacious style, described by the New York Times as resembling the riffs of a brainy stand-up comedian. Whether he's remembering his birthplace of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or mentioning his long-term home in Tallahassee where he teaches at Florida State University, David Kirby travels the world in his poetry, melding memory and imagination like no other. During his spring 2009 visit to the Kansas City Art Institute, I talked with him about his book of new and selected poems, The House on Boulevard Street, a finalist for the National Book Award. Here's Section 1's opening poem, Fair Creatures of an Hour, by David Kirby.
At my 40th high school reunion, the men have these big stomachs and the women have brooches, butterflies, flowers, starfish, big gold salamanders. Why, I want to say, what's with the brooches, girls? But then I just come across as Mr. Smarty Pants Poet, Mr. Irony Boy, Mr. PhD, even if he doesn't make as much as y'all and is therefore, like, totally envious and hateful. Many of our classmates aren't here. As A.E. Houseman says, a lot of athletes do die young from cancer or Vietnam. But the saddest are the ones who took their own lives. Linda McCrane, who thought she was ugly and put a shotgun barrel in the middle of her face. And Freddie Cangelosi, dumped yet again by yet another girl who dated him for his money and found by his parents in the family garage, his Corvette still idling. They could have been happy. Didn't they know? Couldn't they have waited? Frederica Motes was the class hot girl because she had this great honker of a nose and let boys treat her like trash. But then she had plastic surgery the summer after graduation and became chaste and modest and found a guy in college who adored her, who adores her to this day. Two of these women tell Barbara they really liked me in high school because I was funny and nice, which kind of depresses me because it makes me think of all the girls I could have had if I'd been serious and nasty. Remorse is the fatal egg by pleasure laid, according to Cowper, but hey, no egg here, no remorse. Okay, maybe there was a big open-mouth kiss, one for each girl, but shouldn't I have taken them out past the dairy farm to the pond with the live oaks around it on a hot July night, and pressed my mouth to their bodies singly, or, oh my God, together, the three of us sweaty and laughing as the night's starry face beamed on our pale thighs? Well, yeah, but then today they wouldn't be telling Barbara what a prodigy I am, would they? Oscar Wilde says they fly through the dim purple air of Dante who have stained the world with the beauty of their sin. Oh, boy, I think I stained my world with sunlight, maybe. Liquid paper. I don't know, oxygen molecules. Not sin, that's for sure. Or not enough sin. Surely death will come to us all, and to those we love. As the great Albert Goldbarth says, if the author of the Divine Comedy died, and Shakespeare too, who are we to say no? But will it be pretty? Will we say, as Charlotte Bronte did, that our loved ones are gone like dreams, that one by one we watch them fall asleep on our arm? Will we be like Antonio Delfini, whose father went climbing in the mountains, and it was a beautiful day, cold but sunny, and then the weather changed, and the father died in an avalanche. And decades later, his climber son went looking for him, and he searched all over, and just as he was about to give up, he looked over the lip of the little ledge he stood on, and there, in the grays and pinks of the day's last light, he looked down and saw his father, years younger than he was, asleep under the ice. Maybe that's what all the brooches are for, to ward off death, or, since death can't be warded off, to ward off painful death, protracted death, ugly death. Maybe that's why all these women are so happy. Their salamanders are protecting them. From the porch of Clayton Thomas's log cabin palazzo, the class of 62 waves goodbye. 10 years from now, some of them won't be standing here. Someone is crying, though I can't tell who. Then a car turns in the driveway. Its headlights sweep the porch, and suddenly the dark is alive with gold, silver, amethyst, diamonds as hard as stars.
That was Fair Creatures of an Hour from the book The House on Boulevard Street by David Kirby. And that's one of the new poems in this new
right.
and selected
mm-hmm.
poems.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also an unusual new and selected poems because, and you put this in the preface of the book, actually, the fact that you have poems gathered, but they're not chronological and not by book necessarily.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about your creative process, because it's obvious that you were being very creative in the putting together of this collection.
Yeah, I think, Angela, whether I'm teaching a class or writing a single poem or putting together a book, that I kind of know where I want to start and where I want to end, and then the middle parts are very movable to me, and I didn't want to do that old 1971, 1972 kind of chronological order. I wanted to give it a narrative arc and thought maybe I could interest the reader a little bit more in the material rather than somebody just picking it up and saying, oh, yes, I know those old poems. Let's go on to the new ones. And I did put a guide in there, you know, if anybody actually wants to know which books, which poems came from. But I did shuffle them around and kind of give them a structure.
And I like that. I thought that was very creative of you mm-hmm. to mix it up like that, because I've always found that in a collection of poems that often one poem, when it's juxtaposed to another, will somehow give it a different dimension than if it were a standalone poem. And so by taking old poems and putting them up against new poems, in a way, you're making them new again.
Right, and I could actually write some new poems that were links. I mean, of course, I want everyone in there to be freestanding and fabulous and successful on its own, but I could actually do some tailoring and, kind of stitch it up a little bit more tightly. I mean, I'm big on control. And I always tell my students, the first thing that the reader wants to see, and the reader can see it from across the room when the reader is looking at a poem, is that the poet cares enough about it to have some kind of artistic control over it rather than just, well, this is what I, wrote between breakfast and lunch, and here you are. So I wanted the book to kind of radiate that. It's a lower end of showbiz, but it's showbiz. It's po-biz, it's poetry. And whoever's picking that book up could be doing other things. It could be going to the movies or going canoeing in the Everglades. And so I want them to look at it and say, well, this guy must have put some thought into it, and so maybe it's worth my while.
Exactly. I love the fact that inevitably in your poetry, even though a lot of times it can have a lot of pop culture in it, mm-hmm. that you always weave somebody like Dante in through there.
Yeah.
And a lot of classical literary references mm-hmm. appear in your
yeah.
work.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you and a poet that you mentioned in this very poem
mm-hmm.
have in common, you and Albert Goldbarth. Both
right.
of you do that, though your voices in your poetry are very different.
Yes, they are.
Uh-huh. And your senses of humor are different
yeah.
as well, even
yeah.
though you both use a lot of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about that weaving together popular culture and what some
mm-hmm.
people like to refer to as high culture.
Yeah, I guess I don't see the difference. I think about Dante, and then I think about the Dagwood comic strip that I read this morning, and both have a kind of resonance for me, and probably some Dagwood readers don't know who Dante is and vice versa, but it's pop culture to talk about cartoons, but so much of the rest of our culture is kind of cartoon-like. I mean, you brought up Dante, and he shows up in his poems as well, but, the Inferno is kind of one big graphic novel without the graphics. And now Dante is pop culture. When you walk down a street in Italy, you'll see a restaurant ad in a window where there's some kind of riff off of the beginning of the Inferno or something. And cab drivers can quote Dante and will to you. The thing that I'm trying to do in those poems is to show the way the mind works, because a lot of poems, as are just, I looked out the window and I saw such and such, and here are my thoughts on it. And just from common sense, we know the mind doesn't work that way. And, of course, you always read these studies that say during a a big 300-person lecture class, you know, the 20% of the students are thinking about sex. And you know, of course they are, and it's not always the same 20%, because turn a page and that group will be thinking about, you know, the subject matter of the material. People are wondering, you know, where their boyfriends are and if their mom's okay and if their, you know, dad is back from his business trip. Of course, we're all thinking about our lunch. And then things just, you know, they rise and fall. We do have childhood memories just kind of pop up in the middle of nowhere. Or two or three times a day, we all have that experience where you're, you know, you're looking out and you think, this reminds me of something I saw. Where was it? Oh, that's right. It was Indiana. It was that car trip 10 years ago. No, it was 20 years ago when I was, you know, in the back seat and my brother was kicking me. And so it just seems to me that the mind is sort of excitable and jumpy. And I want to reproduce that, but of course with a lot of editing. I mean, maybe what I want to say is that this is what the mind should be doing, because the mind's pretty chaotic.
You capture that flitting around that the mind does, but there's always a forward motion in your poems.
I guess so, but no one should deny themselves anything. And I think often my students, they want to exist in some kind of compartment. They want to be scholarly or not so scholarly, or they want to be a jock or something like that. And I always say, look, you know, what the phrase Renaissance man means is not that you have a command of seven different academic disciplines. It means that you can write a sonnet to a fair lady, you can fence, you can compose music, you read Latin and Greek, you go hunting, you go to war against France if you have to, that. And so, you know, you need to live a full life. You know, I want to get that quality in my poetry, too. You know, just every possibility, I want it to be available, you know, imaginatively to the reader.
Well, that explains a lot. You don't see a difference between high and low, and mm-hmm. that makes sense in that context right there, because mm-hmm. you need it all to have that full life that you're talking mm-hmm. about.
Yeah, it's a kind of high-calorie life, I think, you know. Intellectual and emotional calories.
It's rich. Mm, it's
rich,
a rich life.
Rich, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the Winter Dance Party is a long poem,
mm-hmm.
but is there a part of it that you can read for us to give listeners a sense, and then, you know, they'll have to go buy the book to hear the rest of it.
Let's have a look.
Okay. I'm Angela Elam, and I'm with David Kirby.
My school has a study center in Valencia, Spain, and you know, people say to me often, well, you know, why does Spain or Italy or France show up in your poetry? And the answer is, that's where I have the most time to write, because usually when I'm at home, you know, of course I have my classes to teach and, you know, all the stuff that English professors do, you know, memos and committee meetings and things. And whereas when I'm, you know, strolling around some piazza somewhere, not only do I have the time to write, but I mean, you never feel more American than you do when you are in Rome, for example. As my wife Barbara says, you never feel more American when you're trying to get your dry cleaning back in a language that you can't really speak and they don't have it. You know, so that's when I really think about how rich English is and all the good we can get out of it. So, yeah, I wrote a poem called The Winter Dance Party that is set in Valencia, where I was teaching one summer. This is toward the end of the poem, where I'm reflecting on the Spanish word duende, which is the quality that is often associated particularly with Spanish poetry and Spanish theater. But, you know, it's equal opportunity, isn't it? Anybody can have duende, which is a kind of it's a hard to define word, but it means something like awareness of death. How beautiful is the shadow that the Spanish call duende. How like it is to the food we crave when we are weepy and spent. We want to chew our bodies up whole and swallow them, to fill a museum with the cries of the dying. No wonder Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil, as did Paganini, or that Buddy Holly played his best set the last night of the Winter Dance Party, and then the little plane crashed in the Iowa cornfield. No wonder that, as the joke has it, the redneck's last words were, "Y'all watch this," or that the final thing the general said to his troops was, "On your feet, you cowards, their artillery can't possibly reach us at this dist." Sometimes I wish I had a machine gun. But I want language, too, history, jokes, recorded music, hot meals. I like libraries, theaters, bookstores, though sometimes at night when I'm walking through this city, the wind will blow the leaves past my feet, and I'll hear a howl a few streets over, and I'll think, that's a dog, and then, that's my dog, and then, that's me.
That's just a little bit of the poem, The Winter Dance Party, and it comes from the collection The House on Boulevard Street. You're listening to David Kirby today on New Letters on the Air. You know what? I'm going to ask you if you would read the beginning of The Winter Dance Party, too, okay. Just because that sets up the character of the dog.
Of course it does. The Winter Dance Party begins this way. A dog with a lampshade around his neck is checking me out as I eat a pastelito on a street corner in Valencia one windy evening, and I'm guessing he's got a bobo and he's wearing the lampshade to keep him from biting it, which means he's thinking of little else but, and now he glances at the other dogs as though trying to make deals with them. Bite my bobo for me. Bite my bobo and I'll do anything you want. I'll kill a cat. I'll tear up somebody's garden. I'll do in church. Whatever. And then, of course, the other dogs won't have anything to do with him. And so that's when I bring myself into the action. So now he's looking at me, and he's leaning forward a little, and suddenly his eyes flare with the spurt of a struck match, and it's though he's saying, "Human man, human, here's your chance to be a dog. Bite my bobo. Then you can eat anything you want. You don't have to wait for somebody to wash it or cook it or even wipe it off." I'm glad you're laughing.
Oh, it is too funny. And the funny thing is when you told me about Billy Collins calling you that time, I could just see him being in love with this poem.
Mm-hmm. Actually, before he was poet laureate, he wrote me a postcard and said, "David Kirby, 83% of American poetry is garbage. You write the other 17%. You know, yours, Billy Collins." And when he sent me that, then I called him up and we became friends. And just to show you what a genius you have for an interview subject, I took that card and I put it in, as we all do with precious objects, a safe place. And I hope the listeners can hear the quote marks around the word safe. In other words, I put it someplace where it would, you know, be out of harm's way. And I have no idea where that card is. Yeah. And I've looked for it ever since, because I thought, you know, here's my testimony from the poet laureate that says I'm, you know, one of the few doing the right thing. I have no idea where that darn thing is.
Oh, well, you'll come across it someday.
I bet I will.
Or maybe somebody who's dealing with your estate, because you've stayed in one place all this time.
Yeah.
And you were telling me before we started the interview that you've actually been at Tallahassee teaching there since you were 24.
Yeah, I have.
And I don't know why, but I find that astounding, because so many people do move around with their jobs. And because you're so elastic in your imagination, I just would have thought that you would have bounced around in that same way.
Well, you're the first one to make that connection between my physical stasis and my imaginative jitteriness. You know, Goethe said we should be orderly and bourgeois in our daily lives, so we can be violent and disorderly in our work. And maybe my whole career arc is a version of that, because, I've just sort of been in this one place, and Tallahassee is a very green community, very peaceful, and it's been a great place to work. And I do travel a lot, and, you know, and read a lot and think a lot, and I do try to put lots of peaks and valleys in my poetry, and, you know, and the other writing I do as well. And so I want it to be exciting, and that sort of quiet, nurturing atmosphere has made it possible for me to take more of a roller coaster ride in my work. Maybe if I lived in New York, you know, I'd write like skinny minimalist poems.
I know, it would be kind of interesting to know if you were in a different place, if it would affect you in that way.
You gotta wonder.
Yeah, you do.
I'll never know.
Well, that's all right, because your work is rich as it is. I want to ask you, because you are interested in narrative, and I know that you're writing essays too now. You're primarily a poet, but what got you into essay writing?
Actually, it was the other way around. I'd always written essays, and then I did write a kind of a 2-inch wide, 4-inch long poem for years, and I wanted to do something different, and I wasn't quite sure it was. And then Barbara, my wife, said, "There are all these stories that you dine out on," because I grew up on a farm in Louisiana at a time when television was just sort of coming along, and there were always two stations. You had rabbit ear antennas, They were fuzzy. And also, about 10 o'clock at night, the television went off and didn't come on until the following morning. So it just, it wasn't there 24/7. And so we would sit around and tell stories. And my mother, she was actually 42 when she had me. And she had been born in 1902 in a real working plantation in a much, even a more rural part of the South. So she not only had a storytelling tradition, but she saw marvelous things and terrible things. One day she was riding a horse to school, and she saw some men on a hill, and they waved her back, but it was too late. It was a lynching, and she saw the body hanging from the tree. So she had stories that were riveting, but they also represented real life of a kind that, most of us just don't know anything about. So I had some kind of sense, I guess, of a responsibility of continuing that tradition. And Barbara said, you ought to take some of those stories that you dine out on and turn them into essays. And I thought about that for a while, and they weren't quite turning into essays. And then ka-ching, one day the light came on, and I said, instead of turning those stories into essays, I'm going to turn these stories into poems. And my first poems of that kind were very memory-driven and were very sort of start-to-finish narrative. But then, I kind of ran out of stories. I mean, I've always wondered how these people like Hemingway and James Dickey got along, because they're always writing about battles and bullfighting and stuff. And what are you going to do? Like, go out and pick fights so you can go back and write about it? So the stakes of the game changed. And what I began to do, what I'm doing more of right now, we'll see what happens in the future. But I think of what I'm doing as more of a braid, where I might have no longer one, but two, three, four subject matters, sort of like those lanyards you made, in Girl Scout camp, where you cross the red and the white and then the blue over the red and so forth until you end up with a braid. So you go back and forth between several subject matters and you try to bring them together at the end. You mentioned the National Book Award. There was a reading before the award ceremony, and every reader had 5 minutes, and it's hard for me to do it in 5 minutes because, the poems tend to go on for two or three pages. But I did read Borges at the Northside Rotary. And when you give a reading, anybody who's ever done this knows, you kind of disappear into a zone, and you could be reading to 10 people or 10,000 people, but you're not really aware of the audience. You're concentrating so hard on, hitting the marks and saying the lines and getting everything right and making it a good show for everyone. And so I rely usually on somebody in the audience, and often it's Barbara, for saying, you did this and that and this worked, and even, that didn't work so well, because she's a poet also, and we give each other notes, because this is a big part of our lives, going around and talking to school groups and giving readings. So she was there, of course, with there's a big auditorium, might have been 700 people there, and I read Borges at the Northside Rotary. And as with a lot of those poems where I set up something at the beginning, then I wander away from it and give you a chance to forget it, and then I come back around at the end. So that in that particular poem, I steal the line from Borges where he apologizes to the reader for writing the poem that the reader might have written. And then I, tell some stories, and I come back around to that. And Barbara said that as I was reading the poem, of course, everyone was quiet and attentive. And then she said, the guy behind her said, "My God, he pulled that off." And I thought that was such a wonderful comment, because he was doubting that I could pull it all together, and by God, I did.
I think this is as good an introduction to the mind of David Kirby as anything. Would you read it?
Borges at the Northside Rotary. After they go to the podium and turn in their happy bucks and recite the Pledge of Allegiance and the Four Truths, is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendships? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? I get up to read my poetry, and when I'm finished, one Rotarian expresses understandable confusion at exactly what it is I'm doing and wants to know what poetry is exactly. So I tell him that when most poets think of the word poetry, they think of lyric poetry, not narrative poetry, whereas what I'm doing is narrative poetry of the kind performed by, not that I am in any way comparing myself to them, Homer, Dante, and Milton. And he's liking this. He's smiling and nodding. And when I finish my little speech, he shouts, "Thank you, doctor. Thank you for educating us." And for the purposes of this poem, he will be known hereafter as the nice Rotarian. But now while I was reading, there was this other Rotarian. He kept talking all the time, just jacked his jaw right through the poet's presentation of some of the finest vers libre available to today's listening audience. And he shall be known hereafter as the loud Rotarian. Nice Rotarian, loud Rotarian. It's kind of like good cop, bad cop, or God the Father, Mary the Mother. Buy low, sell high. Win some, lose some. Come see, come saw. Half empty, half full. Merchant copy, customer copy. But in a sense, the loud Rotarian was the honest one. He didn't like my poetry, and he said so. Not in so many words, but in the words he used to his table mates as he spoke of his golf game, or theirs, or the weather, or the market, or, most likely, some good deed that he was the spear-chucker on, the poobah, the mucky-muck, the head honcho. For one thing I learned very quickly was that Rotarians are absolutely nuts over good deeds, and they send doctors to Africa and take handicapped kids on fishing trips, and just generally either do all sorts of hands-on projects themselves, or else raise a ton of money so they can get somebody else to do it for them. Whereas virtually every poet I know, myself included, spends his time either trying to get a line right, or else feeling sorry for himself, and maybe writing a check once a year to the United Way, if the United Way's lucky. The nice Rotarian was probably just agreeing with me, just swapping the geese and fish of his words with the bright mirrors and pretty beads of mine. For how queer it is to be understood by someone on the subject of anything, given that, as Norman O'Brown says, the meaning of things is not in the things themselves, but between them, as it surely was that time those kids scared us so badly in Paris. Barbara and I had got on the wrong train, see, and when it stopped, it wasn't at the station 2 blocks from our apartment, but one that was 20 miles outside of the city, and we looked for someone to tell us how to get back. But the trains had pretty much stopped for the evening, and then out of the dark swaggered 4 tough teenagers, and as 3 of them circled us, the 4th stepped up and asked the universal icebreaker, that is, question, do you have a cigarette? Answer, non, je ne fume pas. Question, you're not French, are you? Answer, non, je suis américain. Question, from New York? Answer, non, Florida. Question, Miami? Non, une petite ville qui s'appelle Tallahassee dans le nord de... And here the kid mimes a quarterback passing and says, ah, l'université avec la bonne équipe de football. He was a fan of FSU sports, of all things, so we talked football for a while, and then he told us where to go for the last train. Now, change one little thing in my life or theirs, and they or I could have been either the loud Rotarian or the nice one. And so I say to Rotarians everywhere, please forgive me, my brothers, for what I have done to you, and to myself as well, for circumstances so influence us that it is more an accident than anything else that you are listening to me and not the other way around, and therefore I beg your forgiveness, my friends, if I wrote this poem before you did.
Borges at the Northside Rotary. That's the final poem in the book, The House on Boulevard Street. New and selected poems by David Kirby. I interviewed him while he was a 2009 guest of the Kansas City Art Institute. For more information, go to newletters.org/radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Eric Motter, Molly Lesher, and Dennis Conroe, with production music by Kevin McLeod. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.